Reds Fans Podcast, coming to you from the Interim Studio 82, a block from the heart of Cedarville, the famous birthplace and final resting place of Reds pitching legend Bumpus Jones. Today, it's just me, Jeff, with another Jeff here on the show. Tom, Kim, John, all those guys, they're all tied up on a Saturday morning with other things. I have a Saturday morning with nothing else to do, so I'm going to talk about Reds with a friend, Jeff Carr. Jeff is in his sixth season of hosting, or co-hosting, I guess you should say, the Locked On Reds podcast. If you haven't listened to that, every weekday morning, they drop an episode, Jeff and his partner Steve. And so Jeff, as if he doesn't talk enough about the Reds, I said, hey, man, you want to get on here and talk Saturday? So here he is, and welcome aboard, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff. I was talking to somebody about that the other day. I said, well, I'd be talking about the Reds even if there wasn't a microphone in front of me. So let's go.
So just tell us a little bit about your show and what you guys try to do with that. Just so anybody who's listening maybe hadn't found yours, I recommend it. Our show is very intermittent, off and on, and we do it mostly to have fun, not to build a gigantic audience. But you guys are building an audience, doing it every day. So just tell us how it's going.
Yeah, it's going fantastic. I mean, our main goal is just to make it fun to be a Reds fan. You know, enhance the experience however we can. We try not to lean one way or the other, but we're pretty optimistic when it comes to most things. Don't ask us about Stuart Fairchild, but other than that, yeah. we love kind of analyzing stuff, and we try to mix, you know, eye test with analytics and stuff like that. I know that, you know, some folks say that we go a little hard on the analytics, but I think that's just part of understanding. I try not to think that I know too much, because the more you know, the more you don't know and stuff.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the podcast, it's just about enjoying this team each and every day in some way.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, every day you can watch a game like you can watch last night's game. And we're doing this on recording this on Saturday, April the 27th. So the night before Graham Ashcraft starts for the Reds and they lose 2-1 in Texas. And, you know, we get baseball such a long season, right, that we get like it's easy to get caught up in every result, every loss, every win, and think that means, I mean, every game counts, but the meaning or the weight of that toward the season as far as the way a team's performing is often you know, overrated and and so forth. But just to see, you know, every game there are, if you look at, well, outside of the outcome of the win and the loss, there's little wins, little losses in the game, right? You know, sometimes wins are costly. Sometimes losses have bright spots in them. And of course, last night would have been Ashcraft, the way he pitched, only giving up one run. And, and that's something that, you say, okay, that's good, right? Let's get this starting pitching. If this starting pitching stays pretty good, this team's going to hang around until maybe they get a little more healthy and get a couple more bats going. So, this month of April, better than recent Aprils for sure. What do you feel like you're learning about this team, and what are those sort of bright spots, like we talked, like, you know, like kind of like the Ashcraft start last night? What have been the bright spots across this month that you think have long-term, I guess, implications, can be really good for this team long-term that you've seen?
I think the first one we start with would be Ellie. I mean, he's a guy this all off-season we kept saying he's got so much talent, so much potential, but the only thing that was fresh in our mind was August and September when he was, you know, pretty quiet at the mm-hmm. plate. He was, you know, making errors in the field, getting caught stealing on base, and you're just like, what's he gonna be? And he has taken off in such a huge way in this month of April. And I think that it's funny because there's a lot of different things that he is doing that he's already approaching some of his like projected totals. Like I saw that Fangraphs had him at 30 stolen bases this year.
Yeah, what's he got? What was he at 18 now or something after last night?
Yeah. I mean, he's already knocking on the door of that. FanDuel had his over under at 42 and a half. You're like, I think he's going to hit that by the All-Star break. He's just going to go crazy with that. But it's also the on-base percentage that has been the biggest surprise for me, because last year, I forget what the ratio was. I think he had like 30 walks and 98 at bats or something like that. Or that even sounds kind of high,
Well,
but
his walk percentage was under 10%, wasn't it? And now it's about 14 or 15 right now, or something like that.
Yeah, the last I looked, it was at 14%, and he got two more last night, so you'd think it probably goes up even higher than that. And that's been the biggest thing for me, because last year, throughout the 98 games that he played, he scored over 55% of the time that he was on base, and he is continuing that trend this year. And that's the kind of guy that you want at the top of the lineup. And then also, pitchers aren't really sure how to pitch him because he's become so patient. You can't just throw him crap and expect him to swing at it now, because he will lay off of it.
Well,
And then he's more dangerous on the bases than he is with the
Well,
bat.
I think he's, yeah. I mean, I Ellie to me is he is a true unicorn. He is someone who we are just who is just scratching the surface of what he is. There have been so many people, and it goes back to this what I said earlier. We overestimate what happens on one in one game or one weekend series or in a week even, and we so many fans tend to label a guy. The labels come fast, and you know, from the first time I saw this guy playing in Dayton, as you know, I saw him in person a lot because I, for those that don't know, I do I freelance. I'm a sports writer too, and I cover the Dayton Dragons for the Dayton Daily News on a regular basis. And so 2 years ago, when Ellie showed up, and he a little bit of a slow start, but then he really got rolling, and just all the different things he could do and did, and his joy for the game, just told me that like the ups and downs will come, as they always do in any sport, especially baseball. But just wait. Just wait, just wait. This guy, I don't care how much he struck out last year. It doesn't matter. You haven't seen this. There's so much talent there, and there's a dedication to the game in him, and I know there is. I mean, I'm not there at the ballpark watching how much he works, but his love for the game is obvious and was very obvious to me, 'cause I got, you know, you see him up close and a little more personal. And the times I got to interview him and talk to him, you could see it. He was all through translation at that time, but I knew he could understand me. He just wasn't ready to really speak in English very well, and so he did it. He tried one night, but he just couldn't pull it off.
I think that's such an underrated part too of his growth, is the fact that he's just like, I want to make sure that nothing gets lost in translation, and I can say exactly what I need to tell you, because you don't see a lot of players do that. And I think that that's like that extra step. It's like extra credit. I wouldn't say that that was a requirement by any stretch, but he does that, and you're like, okay, yeah, this dude is special,
Yeah,
capital
he
special.
is. He is. One night, it was one after he'd been there quite a while, and I'd probably had half a dozen, eight or more interviews with him, and I did a really long piece on him and Jose Torres, who's I think Jose's still in double A. It might be. I'm not sure. They were double play combination, best friends, and Jose was very bilingual. And so we did that, and then one night it was near the end of his time in Dayton, and Juan Samuel was the first base coach for longtime baseball fans. A lot of people would remember Juan Samuel as a really good hitter for the Phillies and infielder. And he was always – he was helpful that season to translate when needed. And so it was after a game, and we down the clubhouse area, found Ellie. I'm like, hey, let's talk. And he's like, okay. And Juan was standing there, and I said, Juan, are you able to help tonight? And he goes, yeah. And Ellie looks at me, and he goes, like, puts his hand up. He says, no. I try. Something like that. You know, he wanted to try to answer me directly in English. Awesome. And so I asked him a question. He looked at me. I rephrased it to try to, you know, because sometimes when you talk to these guys, they kind of understand some of what you're saying. But if you use a certain word, you got to be careful not to use kind of colloquial expressions. You know, you have to be very specific. And so I really tried to do that with what – I don't even remember the question. I couldn't begin to tell you that. And he sort of got this kind of looking up at the ceiling, thinking about what I just said. And then he looked at me, and he tried a couple times to start. And he finally just smiles, a big Ellie smile, you know, and just waves. And he said, no, I can't do it. And so
we appreciate the effort though, right?
Yeah, the effort was there. And so Juan helped, and so then Juan helped with it, and we did the interview. And that moment, like, just showed me so much about a guy who really wants to do things well and doing the best he can. I don't think he puts extra he may have put a little extra pressure on himself at times, but doesn't strike me as an athlete who is putting tons of pressure on himself. He just wants to play the game and have fun and work and get better at it, and be a good teammate. And he's a good teammate. There's no doubt about that from everything I've seen and heard and witnessed myself. So I've never been off the Ellie bandwagon, and some have, but the sky is absolutely the limit for him. And people just need to enjoy what he does, because, you know, he's young now. One of these days he'll be older and won't be able to do all the things he does now. So enjoy it for however long he can run like this and everything. And there's nothing that really can stop him. And the way he has shortened up his swing at times, it used to be a bigger looping swing, which contributes to the strikeouts. And he's still going to strike out some, but I think we're going to continue to see that strikeout percentage go down through his career, because you mentioned it. People are afraid to pitch to him.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to figure out how to pitch to him again, because now he's got a better eye at the plate. He's more disciplined. He's more patient, whatever word you want to use. And that's why he's getting walked now, because nobody's sure. They're expecting him to chase. So just start throwing the ball over the plate and see what happens.
And I think that's something that Nathan Eovaldi did really well for the Rangers last night, was he hit that inside corner. That's probably the biggest opportunity that he has right now to strike out, because he's been taking those a lot. And mm-hmm. I think he stands close enough to the plate that he feels like it's about to hit him, or it's a ball. And then whenever it touches that corner and the umpire gives him a strike, then he's like, what? Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that's something that he's studying, because you mentioned it earlier, like the work ethic is being well reported on, and his time that he spent in the offseason with Juan Soto has really affected that. They mentioned that in batting practice, he doesn't just go into the cage now and swing away. He goes in there with a purpose. He's like, okay, you know, for these next couple of pitches, I'm going to pinpoint this location in left field, and I'm going to hit it here. And then for the next, I'm going to pinpoint this location in right field, and I'm going to hit it there. And he's doing all of those things. So that is where, because we've seen the opposite field power really show out early on this season, and we've seen the ability where he hits a 100-mile-an-hour line drive, that it's a single or it's a double, but it's impactful, because when you can do that and when you put yourself on base, there's not a pitcher in this league that doesn't start getting a little bit antsy on the mound when they look over and they see 44 on first.
Yeah.
Because they know that probably in two pitches he's going to be on third.
Well, which is exactly what he did the other night when they were up 6-4 and he got a hit in the, what was it, the eighth, ninth inning maybe? Or the bottom of the eighth, I suppose. They were at home. So it was like, you know, bottom of the eighth, he gets a hit, steals second, steals third, scores on a sac fly. I mean, that's basically like – that's like hitting a home run. You know, he does stuff like that, and it's like, well, yeah, that's like hitting a home run. Now, Espinal or whoever it was, or Steer, I don't remember, hit the sac fly for him. They had to do their part too, but he puts that in position. And these numbers about like how often he scores when he gets on base and stuff like that, that's crazy because this team isn't hitting that great. Everybody else and in a lot of games, and he still scores a lot because he gets those extra bases that they're kind of like, you know, and I liken it to football, like when they talk about receivers and they talk about yards after the catch, kind of those hidden yards.
Exactly.
Ellie gets like hidden yards, you know, and now they're not hidden because they count as stolen bases and everything, but they're not produced by the bat. He gets bases that aren't produced by the bat a lot, and that's why the Reds play the way they do. And they're scoring at a pretty good clip, actually, right? Aren't they? I don't know the numbers in front of me, but they're scoring at a pretty good clip this year without really hitting the ball great as a whole. And it's all these extra hidden bases, hidden yards, so to speak, that they get. So that to me is a huge positive that I'm seeing in April, because when other guys get back and other guys start to hit the ball more consistently, which you know some of them are, you know, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, he has, I wouldn't say that he's single-handedly propped up the team's scoring, but it feels that way. Like in baseball, it's really hard to be a one-man show, but
yes,
he's been as close as you possibly can to do that. And the other guy for me in the lineup that's really kept them going, and even though he's kind of gone through a bit of a slump here recently, but he broke out of it last night, is Spencer Steer.
Yeah.
And he is so consistent with the way that he approaches the game. And they said it on the broadcast last night, like he went through an 0-for-18 slump, but it's not as if all of those 18 at bats were strikeouts or weak contact, or you know, it was just throwaway stuff. Like he was still hitting the ball hard, they were just finding gloves.
Right.
And he's the kind of guy that you can safely put, and I heard some folks asking, well, Steer's in a slump, why is he batting third? It's like, because he is the most consistent hitter that this team has. Even if everybody else is going right, I think that Steer is always going to be that guy. He's always going to be around 270, 280. His on-base is always going to be around 340, 350. And his slugging's probably always going to be around 450 because he's just right there where you need him to be. I don't think he's ever going to be, you know, getting MVP votes or, you know, anything flashy like that. But he is going to be the dude that makes sure that, you know, if you got runners in scoring position, he's going to bring him in. Or if you need somebody on base, he can do that too. And he's got a little bit of speed. I wouldn't trust him to steal second and third in one at bat,
no.
But definitely get the second if he just walks or gets a single.
Right, and he can be part of that double steal thing with Ellie, which that kind of stuff, you know, it's just crazy. And I love Steer. You know, he got off to this, you know, red hot start. And I don't know what you think of this, but I'm obviously a big Ellie fan. And not just because, well, somewhat because of my, you know, I wouldn't say a relationship I had with him, but the closeness there that I got to see him up so up close and personal so much when
right.
he was in Dayton, but and everything, and just enjoyed the interactions that we had. But you know, Steer hot, you know, McClain gets hurt, right? So we don't have McClain to begin with, and I hear people say, well, he's our best player. I'm like, I don't know about, I don't agree with that.
Right.
Steer's our best. Now, oh man, Spencer Steer's our best player. No, he's not. Ellie is the best player on this team, and to me, there's no debate and not just because, and I would have said that before the season started, not just because he's been had a good April, right. But we got to quit as fans. These guys don't care about that. We get hung up on that. Fans get hung up on that. Well, who's the best player? I mean, who cares? You got a bunch of guys when healthy that this team's going to really, I think, really rake at the plate. And they've got some guys have got to figure some things out. But Ellie is, he's, you know, to borrow a really old phrase from a long time, long ago Hall of Famer, he is the straw that stirs this drink. Without, to me, you know, he's the, you know, they talk about the rising tide lifting all the boats, and he's the rising tide, I think. And I just, this team will go as he goes. And I think April's proved that, because without him doing what he's been doing, what are they going into today? 14-12? I mean, they're maybe 12-14 without him doing what he's doing, and they might be worse than that. So
right, at best, because like there's some games that he has just taken over. Like yeah. I remember early on whenever they were in Philadelphia, they played that game that Bryce Harper hit 3 home runs, and I said, I'm like, man, I hope Ellie was paying attention, because you can be the reason that your team wins a game.
Yes.
And I think that there's a pressure with that, and I think that there's a lot of fans. It's funny, because I think that if you're a diehard baseball fan, there's like some sort of ingrained thing, and I do this too, where it's just like, you got to find the guy on the team that nobody's talking about, and you got to pump him up like you know what you're talking about. And it's just like, at the end of the day, the easy answer is Ellie, and it shouldn't really change, because as much as it's nice that there is this problem where, okay, well, you can debate that maybe this guy is the best player, or maybe this guy is the best player. That's a great problem to have, because for the last, 12 years, the obvious answer has been Joey Votto. Mm-hmm. And there's not really been another player that you would argue for that. And the huge reason for that is you feel like, well, they signed Joey Votto to this long-term deal, and they just decided that they're not really going to try too hard to build around him. Well, now they've got this super young core, very talented core of, you know, you can almost go 6-7 deep on the guys that we're talking about. And it's fun to debate, but the answer is Ellie all day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that takes nothing away from Steer, no. From McClain, from Encarnacion, Strand, or anybody, or Stevenson, whatever. I think it doesn't take anything away from that. I mean, exactly. You know, we can, any team in baseball, you can like, well, who's the best player? Well, okay. But you need more than that. You need a bunch of really other great solid players. And I think McClain and Steer are the two guys who can be the most consistent, who have shown that they can be at this point. It's just too bad we don't have McClain. That would be big, but because I think he'd be playing well, and probably be worth a couple more wins. He might have got a couple key hits that won a couple games, that because they're, you know, all these one run games they play. But you know, it hasn't happened, so other guys have to step up. Espinal did the other night in that last series, a couple games. They just need more of that. What are you seeing with Encarnacion Strand? I mean, he's just chasing too much. Is there anything? Yeah. Is there anything more than that?
I don't think so, because what he does hit, he's hit very hard.
Yes, I agree.
So he's definitely not getting cheated there. He had a day. It was the third game of the Philly series, Wednesday night at the Bark in the Parking.
Yeah.
Where he walked twice, and I'm like, ooh, is he starting to see the ball a little bit better? But then Zach Wheeler kind of snapped him out of that.
Right. And he swung at he swung at a strike three way, and that was never had a chance to. Right. You know, when guys swing and miss on a third strike, that a ball that just breaks out of the zone. I mean, hats off to the pitcher, but he struck out on one last night that never even started in the strike zone.
It's like, right, I think it was like out and low.
Yeah, it was away and low. It's like that never had a chance. And that's what. Ellie's learned to stay off of that stuff. So I think CES can and will. It's just, you know, he's adjusting now to the way they adjusted to him off of last year, and he's got to figure some stuff out.
Our favorite April expression as well. He's pressing, but I kind of think that's what he's doing. I think that he sees the one at the beginning of his batting average, and he's like, well, this next at bat, I've got to get it back up to two. And it's just like, nah, you need to build on that. You got to do a couple of at bats, a couple of good stuff. And I think that if Joel McKeithen or if David Bell or whoever just kind of, like, you know, taps him on the shoulder and just says, hey, man, just go up there and have one good at bat and see what happens.
Exactly. Bat to at bat, pitch to pitch, and quit. Right. Yeah. Yeah, they worry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because you see that a lot with guys. And I remember last year, early on, before he was called up in AAA, there was a stat, and it was J.J. Cooper at Baseball America was talking a lot about this. He said that Christian Encarnacion Strand is probably the best bad ball hitter in the minor leagues, because he says that his swing percentage outside the zone is much higher than average, but his contact percentage on those pitches is almost double average. And so I'm like, I don't know if that's a good thing, because then he's thinking he can swing outside.
Right. And that's something he's probably got. That's something he's having to learn. It's like, these guys are better pitchers, and those pitches are going to be a little bit better and a little harder to hit, that they're going to change speeds more effectively. They're going to do a lot of things better than those guys did in single A, double A, or triple A. And so So I'm sure that's a thing going on. The fact that he walked two times the other night is probably a product of trying to work on that, but you don't just master it overnight. So that's a thing. I think you're right about it. He has to not worry about his batting average. I think the worst thing a baseball player can do is look at his batting average. Yep. You can't do that. I've really, in recent years, come to believe even more than I ever did this idea of, it's not about the outcome. If you're focused on the outcome, you're going to press, you're going to try and do things you're not capable of doing. You just have to fundamentally do what you're supposed to do, you know, and be that guy and let those results take care of themselves. And boy, that's hard. I mean, golfers struggle with that. Shooters in basketball struggle with that. I'm sure quarterbacks struggle with that. Pitchers, hitters, guys who, you know, when the ball is the thing that makes something happen in a sport, when that ball is in your hand or you have the chance to hit it or whatever, that's that outcome you're trying to control. And you know, once the ball leaves the bat, you have no control. Same thing with hitting a ball off the tee. You have no control. And I coached high school golfers for years, and that was one of the biggest things to try to get in their head. It's like, hit that ball and forget about it. Move on to the next shot. You know, you just, once it leaves the tee or the ground, you have no control. You know, like when a shot leaves your hand, you have no control. And if CES can, he probably knows this, easier said than done. That's the mental part of the game that I think all the talent is there for a lot of these guys. And who handles the mental part the best are the ones that become stars and productive everyday players for many years. And I think Ellie has the right mindset right now. And if we get CES having the right mindset and so forth, then he'll take off.
What was it? Didn't Yogi Berra say 90% of the game is half mental?
Yeah, and you know, it's always been that way. But everybody, us on the outside, there's so much focus on the production, the numbers, you know, that it's hard. You know, it's hard for an athlete when they're hearing that outside noise, I think, to deal with that well. Especially young guys, I think it's harder for them, and I think we're seeing that. You know, Lucas Sims gives up a home run last night. I don't know if he made a bad pitch or not. It looked like Simeon turned on that pretty well and did a, you know, and had a good at bat. So Sims has to think he's got to like not carry that with him. He's got to let that go, and like, hey, I made a pretty good pitch. Give the guy credit. You know, it's just like. Wheeler one night, Eovaldi last night. The Reds hitters have got to be like, you know, they've got to be determined to be better, but at the same time, they can't. Sometimes you just got to say, well, the other guy was better than me tonight, and move on and focus on the next guy. That's not a giving in and giving up. That's a reality check sometimes. And I, you know, and so that's what has to happen. And this team is having the best April they've had, and a third of their batting order is out.
Right. Some more of them even on any given day is out with like an illness or something like that.
That's been crazy. Who knows? Maybe Jonathan India would have started hitting the ball better here this past week, but he didn't get to play. So who knows?
Right. But you talk about, you know, journey over destination. And I think that that's a perfect segue to talking about Hunter Green.
Yeah.
Cause he's a guy that it feels like every day, if he doesn't go out there and throw a no hitter, there's a bunch of folks that get on there and they're like, oh, well, see, he's a closer. And then there's some other folks that get on there and they say, well, they just need to get rid of him because he's not ever going to be as good as he should be. And it's just like, guys, he's not even pitched 500 career innings yet, minor or major leagues.
And he missed two whole seasons.
Right. And he's still in his professional baseball infancy, as it were. So he's really still getting out there. And the perfect storm of reactions is going to be Saturday night's game, where you've got Hunter Green going up against Michael Lorenzo.
I know.
And a guy that, you know, he did great for this club as a relief pitcher, and, you know, had some really emotional at bats in there as well, and great things that he was able to do even playing a smidge of center field. And there were a lot of folks that whenever the Reds kind of let him go, it was like, well, why'd you let him go? Well, he wants to be a starter. That doesn't figure into our plans and things like that. So, and he's bounced around a little bit, but he's pitched in the playoffs and he's had some success. So how does he match up on Saturday with Hunter Green, who we all know at some point everything's going to click, just like Ellie. I mean, Ellie's the unicorn in that it's clicked so fast, but Hunter Green has so much talent, far too much talent for us to already be looking at contingency plans for his career. Like, it's going to click soon enough. It's just, it's not quick enough for our microwave brain society to watch.
It's not. And Hunter, this is just my opinion. You can call it a hot take if you want. But it's an opinion that I've had for a long time, because I saw him up close and talked to him a lot after a lot of games in Dayton. I think Hunter is his own worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is I'm trying to think how I want to express this. He talks about, how many times have you heard him say, I just have to trust my stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he says that a lot. So I wonder, but I don't think he does.
No.
He, you know, as a kid growing up, he could just throw the ball past everybody. And so he's had to learn how to be a pitcher because he just can't throw the ball past major league hitters. I just don't think he really does, because, and I think some of the extra proof in that is here. It's like, well, I've worked on this pitch and that pitch, you know, but he's not really going to it much, right?
Right.
So what is the pitch he's supposed to be throwing more this year?
The splitter is what he's been working on.
And if he could just clone Fernando Cruz's splitter, then then he would be completely unhittable. But I don't think mentally, not that he's got mental issues, I don't mean it that way. I think he's confident in him, in his overall ability and talent. He knows who and what he is in that. But I don't think his confidence in the pitch by pitch, day to day type of thing is there. I just don't think he trusts it because he doesn't use it enough. That's one signal. And And when he says trust my stuff over and over and over again, when he says like, I'm just trusting my stuff, trusting my training, the fact that he says that so much is sort of like, I'm not sure you do, right? Why would you have to say that so much? You know, it's like he doth protest too much, right? I mean, it's that whole, it's that thing of like, you're talking about that so much, I'm not sure you really believe it. And so, and that's not a, I'm not trying to put him down. I'm just saying that's just right. Where he is in his maturation as an athlete, as a pitcher, because he just, like, he missed 2 years. How old is Hunter right now? Is he 23?
24.
He's really 22. In a pitching maturation sense, because he, you know, the COVID year and the ace and the Tommy John year. I mean, he and you know, and we like to look at, and I've seen all these stats about, you know, a lot of guys who at this stage, you know, Cueto, for example, the numbers are similar this far in and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like everybody else. I want to see the next Dwight Gooden, right?
Right.
But, I mean, Dwight Gooden, who took the league by storm as a rookie when he's, what, 19 or 20, you know? Those guys are, that's like a Griffey Jr., too. Those guys are, they might even be every two generations, not just once a generation, because guys just don't do that. And that's what people are expecting. It's like, oh, he's going to come in and just be great from day one. Well, no, but 4 years from now, he might have a Cy Young Award too. So we'll see.
And you mentioned the number of innings and the years that he's missed and stuff like that, and then the trust in his stuff. Because I think, like you said, like he really thinks he can throw the ball past some guys at some times, and I think that's because the ratio of innings where he has spent throwing the ball past people to innings spent in major leagues is still far overweighed to the point where he's like, well, I know I can trust my fastball to get past somebody.
Yeah.
He's just not had enough time, and he's not given enough time to his secondary stuff. Even his slider, which is the second pitch that he has, I feel like there are some days you can see, like, if he's not locating it the way that he wants to, he kind of gives up on it pretty quickly.
Yeah, he does.
And to say nothing of the splitter, or he's even working on a curveball and stuff like that. Because, like, I think his first 2 years of his major league career, he threw a changeup, quote unquote, but it was only like 5% of the time, 6% of the time. It was not even enough for a hitter to really consider it as part of his arsenal. And usually it was outside the zone anyway. It wasn't a competitive pitch.
Right. If you're throwing it 5% of the time, I mean, that's 1 out of 20 pitches. I mean, every three guys at the plate might see it. So you can't look for that. You're just looking for that fastball.
Right. And that's where, if he locates his fastball pretty well, then he can start to build on his other pitches. But the other part of leaning on that fastball is sometimes he just rears back, throws it, and he doesn't really know where it's going to end up in the zone.
Right. Okay. Well, we're pretty far into this. So I don't want to keep you too long today on a Saturday morning. But I've said that if they can get to the 1st of June, anything over 500, that'll be an accomplishment, especially with the injuries they've had and so forth. Do you feel that way, or do you feel like if they don't really own this next month and really get themselves to 6, 8, 10 games over 500, they're in trouble? Or do you think if they come out of this right at 500 even, they're okay?
Right at 500 is I think should be the goal, because their next 4 weeks, really, up until Memorial Day, they are just playoff team after playoff team. And then the only two teams that they faced that were non-playoff teams were right there with them all the way last year in San Francisco and San Diego.
Right.
The weird schedule, and I know that they created this schedule so that everybody plays everybody and you see every team in a given year, but it almost feels like they've somehow unbalanced it to the point that, I mean, this entire next 4-week stretch, they get all of their West Coast trips in.
I know.
And I think the furthest west they go after this stretch is to Colorado, and even that's in the first week of June. So then they're done with the West Coast
Right.
before Juneteenth. So when you look at these next 4 weeks, I mean, they've got 12 games on the West Coast. They're playing the Diamondbacks, or they're playing their entire season series with the Diamondbacks, with the Dodgers, with the Padres, with and with the or no, I think they have a series later on at home against San Francisco, but they go to San Francisco in that long 12
Right.
game trip. These are the types of road trips that even gave the Big Red Machine fits.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all because you go two time zones. You know, you go to the Pacific time zone, and that's not really something that you can ever really get used to on a short trip like that.
Right.
So there's a human element to it that we are going to try to analyze the baseball side and the performance side and be like, you know, man, are they okay? And the answer is yes, because they're in a weird situation for a human being
Right.
to jump all these different time zones, but especially being sort of shorthanded and stuff like that. Like, hopefully, we heard the report yesterday that, you know, hopefully TJ Friedl is a little over 2 weeks away from returning, and that will
Yeah.
be a huge shot in the arm to the ball
I
club.
would
But,
think so. I would think it would be. I think it'll just give them, it'll raise the confidence of the team as if nothing else. I mean,
yes.
I think those things happen, and I guess it's better to if they're gonna I haven't looked at anybody else's schedules. Anybody else have so much West Coast packed into this? Are the other teams in the Central doing the same thing?
I don't think it's till later on in the season for
Yeah,
the Cubs, but
so
yeah,
maybe getting
that's.
it out of the way early is for the best. I don't know. I'd hate to end the season. I'd hate to have August be this.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
If you're in a tight race, and then it's like the pressure mounts a lot. It's gonna be there's fatigue to this, so I guess you would assume trying to find the bright side of it. If there's fatigue in this, at least it's early season.
Right.
You
And
have
something
a
you can.
chance to recover. You got an all-star break coming up eventually, and if you're gonna go out, you know, maybe going out west for a long time, you start to get used to the time change a little bit, and you play better. You get more used to that, and then you finish this trip. Maybe you finish the trip strong as a result, versus flying out there every now and then, and it's always you're jet lagged every time you go out there. So I'm just trying to find the positives of it, and maybe it won't be as bad. You know, is there any silver linings to this? I don't know, but it's going to be tough, and it is weird that they haven't really competed in the division yet very much.
Yeah, we made that joke. I was on the pod the other day. We're just like, they're in the NL Central, right? And Steve's like, well, it feels like they're in the NL West at this
Yeah, it
point.
feels like the days out. Well, yeah, when I was growing up, and it was the Dodgers, the Padres. It was a weird. Of course, the divisions were strange then because it was Dodgers, Reds, Padres, Giants, and Braves. You know, that was just an odd thing. Of course, the Braves didn't matter because they were so bad in
Right.
the 70s, and then not until they got good, and you know, not until Bobby Cox showed up and they started getting pitching. But yeah, they were usually pretty bad. But anyway, so. Yeah, well, I'm glad you feel the same way about that. That's how I've looked at it. Get through this. Anything at 500 or better is an accomplishment. And I think they can. You know, Ashcraft pitched well last night.
Right.
If Hunter pitches well today, gives them a chance to win. Maybe they'll find a way to get it done today. I mean, I'm not scared of Michael Lorenzen on the mound by any means, but I know he can pitch a nice game, but not scared of him.
No, and that's kind of the key, like you mentioned with Ashcraft and with Hunter Green and Lodolo and Abbott, their last two starts have been a little bit of a struggle, but not like bad
No.
struggles. And I think that if you got a starting pitching group that's going to give you a solid 5 innings, because that's really how the game is now. I know, you know, people want to be like, well, go six, go seven. It's like the guys who go 7 innings, like Ashcraft almost went seven last night. That's because they are just going so well. Like pitching, the strategy of pitching nowadays has almost turned to, you know, you go really, really hard for five innings, and then we got a bullpen that's going to take care of the rest. And really, the Reds kind of do. I love their bullpen this year. They've got a lot of great guys that they can call on, but pitching is going to be the key to this long stretch because, I mean, we've seen the hitting. It's not quite there yet, and, you know, the old saying, well, when the weather warms up, so do the bats.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to be quite into the month of June yet before they're done with all this stuff. So the pitching is going to have to be there. They're going to have to win. And I said that they won't do too many of this year, but they're going to have to win some 2-1 ball games and some 3-2 ball games because, you know, you're not just going to go to Los Angeles and face the Dodgers and score 4 runs every night.
Or, no.
Especially not with Arizona. Their pitching staff is phenomenal. You're not going to expect that with them. So you're going to have to outpitch the other team in some of these games. And, you know, the sky's the limit with this pitching staff, but we've also seen that the floor can be pretty frustrating and low sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, they're still a young group. They just are, you know. And I think last year raised expectations for this season, maybe more than we have a right to expect, possibly. Time will tell on that, of course. But you know, baseball's following. It's not fun if you don't have some optimism and have some expectation. And with that, just kind of maybe finish with this. I mean, what are you on record as saying as far as this team's postseason chances?
I think they're making the postseason. I really think, too, and this first, you know, really important season series with the Phillies that they now have the tiebreaker with, is just showing to me that they've got the chops to get them there. Whether it's wild card or division, I'm not sure. I think it'll be harder for them to get a wild card than for them to get the division. But I think that they've got the horses in the barn, as it were, to get them there. Because, like, I know that the Cubs are a little bit banged up with Justin Steele not being on the team, and I think they're missing a couple of key relief pitchers. And now Cody Bellinger hit the IL for them as well. But I think the way that the Reds are playing without three of their most important players is just showing to me that once everybody's here and ready to go, and even before McClain gets back, because I still I think I'm very happy that they said August is a possibility, but I still think that it's very optimistic for the surgery that he had.
I agree. I'm not sure how good he can be short term after that either. How well can he play coming off of that? Even if he's back by early August, maybe if you get in the postseason, maybe he's really starting to feel it mid September or something, but that's asking a lot. He's not just so many people are going to expect him to just step into the lineup and be what he was last year. And it may take longer than that.
I totally agree on that. And that's where this development with all these other guys has been so important. So I definitely think postseason is within the realm of reality with this team. And it's not just a, you know, rose or reds colored goggles view of stuff. And I think they could win the division, especially if they come out of it. I said, and I've repeatedly said, if they come out of this stretch 500, just 500, they're cooking with gas, because this division is definitely winnable.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, the Pirates started fast and then they've slipped, and, you know, the Cubs and the Brewers are playing well right now, but they're going to have their struggles, and nobody in this division's winning 100 games. So it's not like you can't win this division. Nobody's winning 95. So it's definitely there for the taking, and we just have to wait and see what happens. And, I think the pieces are in place in this division to have a shot. And I guess we'll just see. On our group here, we before the season, our first episode, I picked them to win 89 games, and the other guys picked 88, 87, and 90. So we're right all in that high 80s, and I think that gets them in some one way or the other.
Yeah, I feel like that's the right range, like, especially if they, and I don't know what this looks like and what Nick Kroll is able to do, but if they go out and they make like a move or two at the trade deadline, I could see them eke into that 90 range. I saw something this was before the Rangers series started, but saw something that said they were on pace for 95 wins. I feel like that's a little bit too high, but probably right there around 88 to 90 is a perfect range and where they're going to end up.
Well, if you win, I figured they were 5-4 at one point, and I saw some moaning about it, and like 5-4, and like, okay, what's the winning percentage? Okay, that's the same winning percentage as if you go not win 90 games. So if you win 5 out of every 9 games, if you go 5-4 on average every 9 games, you get to 90. And then when you look at it that way, it's like, okay, that sounds doable.
And that's why it's so hard in April to be a baseball fan, because I feel like there's a lot of folks, especially when your team has a lot of hype and a lot of expectations, there's a lot of folks that are big time fans of other sports that come in and they're just like, well, what are they doing? They're only 5-4. Like, that's not very good. It's like, yeah, no, it is. Like, you just got to give it a while because there's like 150 more games left.
And the things even out. The teams that are hot now tend to cool off. The
Right.
1990 team was as hot as they could be the first half of the season, and then they were 500 team down the stretch, and then they figured, then they pulled it together and won the World Series. So those things happen. Look at that. A few years ago, when the Nationals won the World Series, they had a losing record in well into. Did they have a losing record at June 1, or was it? Did they get over 500 by then? It was pretty deep.
No, it was into June, because I remember they were talking, there were rumblings about, do you fire Davey Martinez? And it's like, well, good thing they didn't do
Good thing they didn't do
that.
that. They turned it on. So that doesn't happen every year, but it just those things show that, and then. A team like the Dodgers goes out and wins over 100 games and can't win the World Series. So it's who thought the Rangers would win it last year? So it's
Right.
all we have to wait and see. It's a funny game. It's a funny game, in that regard. So, all right, man. Well, I think I've kept you long enough. We're pushing 45, 50 minutes here. But I'll give you a last word if you want one about anything, or and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, I think last word I'll say this for Fernando Cruz, because I think he's become the best relief pitcher in this bullpen, and I do include Alexis Diaz in that. I think Fernando Cruz has gotten to the point that splitter, and I forget how many times he's thrown it this year, but it's enough that you can be like, at least raise an eyebrow at it. He hasn't allowed a hit with it, and I'm sure he's gonna allow a hit at some point, but he has just the craziest statistics on that. And I know that Steve Mancuso over at Reds Content Plus did a thing about it, like analyzing it. He's up over 75% on the swing and miss with that. Like, it's he there's numbers about him, and the fact that he has gotten to this point in his career now to where people are talking about, like I'm talking about, him being the best relief pitcher in the bullpen, and how hard he has had to work just to get here. It's such a fantastic story, and I'm so glad that I'm able to make that argument for him.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, he's like the mid-inning closer. Like he's the guy to come in and close off the threat in that sixth inning, seventh inning, whatever it is, or it was a fifth one night. He closes that off, shuts it down, and then we move on to the rest of the game. And then if you need Diaz late, you got him. And that's and by saying Cruz is by putting Cruz up there to say I think he's the best reliever they have, that's no slight on anybody else. That's just how good he's pitching. And
Exactly.
I think it's fun to watch it. The swing and misses he gets, I mean, I watched Bruce Sutter do that for years for the Cubs. I don't know if you remember Bruce Sutter, but if you got to see him pitch at all, but he was as I recall, he was the first guy with this split-fingered fastball, and that thing would just roll in there and drop off the table, and nobody could hit it. If he had that, when he had that pitch going, which he did for years, he was untouchable. And Cruz is doing the same thing and moving it around his zone a little bit too. He had one kind of up in his zone. Somebody swung through the other night, took a little bit off of it, and it just like, wow, that was that guy just went back to the dugout shaking his head.
He's
Because
like,
he's like,
what was
I
that?
can't hit that. That's and then I loved him after the game where they interviewed him, and then somebody asked him about it, do you feel unhittable? And he's like, no, I don't. I'm not going to say I'm unhittable. And that's a good, humble way to think about it. That's a good, grounded way to think about it and not get ahead of yourself and always keep working. He's had to work so hard to get where he is. I don't think Fernando Cruz is going to start taking things for granted. So,
no, not at all.
Yeah, anyway. All right, Jeffrey, I appreciate your time being on here. People can find you on Twitter or X at
Jeff Carr with three Fs.
Jeff Carr with three Fs. Jeff with three Fs. And then the Locked On Reds podcast, you can get that on really probably any podcast platform. And I recommend, if you like to keep up with the Reds on a day-to-day basis and like to just kind of hear what's going on, because you watch the games and or you miss a couple games because you're busy and you kind of catch up. You guys are usually around about a 30 to 40-minute show, maybe sometimes a little less. And they just kind of catch you up on everything day-to-day. And it's you guys talk about everydayers. I won't say I'm an everydayer, but I listen quite a bit and just like to catch up with you guys, and especially if I miss a couple games or see half of a couple games and don't really get to watch that much, and it just kind of brings some stuff into focus of like what's happening with the team. So appreciate the work you guys do over there. Yeah. So
appreciate you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. And so next time on this show, I probably have some of my regular cohorts on here, and hopefully we will be talking about a Reds team that is either in the middle of a really great West Coast swing or coming off of one, or at least being above a 500 team in early June and right there within striking distance of whoever is still kind of holding on to this division at that point, whether it's the Cubs or the Brewers. But positivity reigns in Reds country right now, I think, because we see good things happening and we know there's help coming and it's youthful and they're just going to keep getting better. And so whatever happens this year happens, but the future is bright. And I remind people too that who want to go back, and I love the Big Red Machine, but I'm tired of living in the past. But the 75-76 teams won the World Series. But you know what? They were really good for a few years before that and didn't win one. So this team may win one someday, this core group, but it can take a few years to get there. It's really rare for somebody to build in baseball and be like, go win a World Series in a couple years. That's really, really hard. But I think we've got the core group to eventually do it, and we'll see what happens. So until next time, thanks again to Jeff Carr for being here. And as we always like to say on here at the end of things, go Reds.